Hello, wrestling fans. This is Al Getz welcoming you to another episode of Charting the Territories, the only podcast that takes a data-driven look at pro wrestling in the territorial era. I also want to say that all statements made by me on this podcast reflect my personal beliefs and may not reflect the beliefs of my co-host or any guests. Abolish ICE, fuck Trump. And now, let's welcome my co-host, John Boucher.
Oh, well, you can... It's
up to you. You can just go on and say hello to everybody.
I'll say hello to everybody first, and you know, it's pretty safe to say that 99% of what the thoughts expressed by Al Getz are also expressed by John Boucher. So
yes, we're like peanut butter and peanut butter.
Yes.
So this month on the podcast, we will be looking at women's wrestling in the U.S. in the early 1970s, which over the course of the last few years in this podcast was something we very rarely touched on. Yeah. But we're going to look at some of the wrestlers who worked with Fabulous Moolah and her crew, as well as those who were based elsewhere, with an emphasis on Kansas-based Betty Nicolai. We'll also discuss how the women were positioned on the cards in most places and what their role was in this era when they were booked into a territory. But before we get into it, I do have something that I want to talk about. John, they say all good things must come to an end. Hmm. And I guess that means that charting the territories is a good thing.
Yes.
I have made what at first was a pretty difficult decision, and that is to, finish up my run in the wrestling historian territory. Before I get into the specifics, I do feel the need to share with our listeners, and John, you and I have talked a little bit about this, but we'll talk about some things that I haven't even told you, but want to share with all of you what has led me to this decision. When I started charting the territories, 2018, 2019, it was meant to be a fun hobby. And as I continued, I got a lot of positive feedback from many, many people, and I decided to devote more of my time to it, adding this monthly podcast in 2020, and then writing a series of books starting a couple of years ago. And over the last few years, what started as a fun hobby has become much, much more time-consuming than the typical hobby. And at the same time, it became less and less fun for me. Earlier this year, I tried to work on my time management and see if I could scale back the amount of hours I spent on charting the territories. I'd say to myself, let's spend, you know, only X hours per week on it. And invariably, I'd hit X hours by Tuesday. Maybe I'd take Wednesday off, but then on Thursday, I'd say, well, let's get started on next week's allotment, and then I'll have even more free time next week. And then after finishing up the following week's allotment in those next 2 days, I'd say, well, next week I can get even more ahead if I start, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah.
And so on and so on. And I pretty much ended up spending the same amount of time on it that I had been. So after that experiment failed, I decided to literally take 2 months off from work on everything charting the territory related, except for this podcast. So working on the books, doing research, all the data entry and all the calculations and stats that come with it. I stopped at doing that 100% for 2 months. And I found myself with vastly improved mental health. And not only that, but physical health as well. I became much more dedicated to exercise and dieting. And I actually I've lost almost 15 pounds so far this year, 15 pounds. It sure seemed like the amount of time I had put into charting the territories was causing a tremendous amount of stress and affecting multiple areas of my life. And at the same time, I began talking to a therapist. I really wanted to see what was going on in my head and why I kept dedicating more and more of my time to charting the territories and if there was a path to scale back and keep charting the territories going, maybe no books, you know, maybe and just cutting back somehow. And in the course of undergoing this therapy, I realized that this is actually a long-standing pattern in my life. Finding a new hobby or passion that I enjoy and spending so much time and becoming so immersed in it that it no longer becomes a hobby and it no longer becomes fun. And then I have to quit and find something else. So it's not just limited to my work as a wrestling historian. It's just something that is seemingly hardwired in me. So that, coupled with what happened when I tried to manage my time better, it became clear that the best decision for me personally was to cease charting the territories altogether. I know a lot of you listening might not be pleased to hear that, as so many of you have told me how much you enjoy the podcast. And believe me, I don't want this to have been the best answer, but I have to do what's best for myself, for literally my mental health and my physical health and well-being. So John, I want to thank you for your friendship and your contributions to Charting the Territories over the years. The first episode of this podcast came out in June 2020, which means this is our 5-year anniversary.
Wow.
And I vividly remember as we were recording it, there were some protests going on that, of course, would eventually become whitewashed and turn into something else. And here we are, the day we are recording this podcast, 5 years later, something very similar is happening.
Wow.
Which is interesting and scary and worth talking about. Going back to you, John, I can't imagine a better possible co-host for this podcast than you. Your knowledge of this time period of pro wrestling, and in particular, your knowledge of the wild and wacky stories serves as the perfect balance to my more analytical approach. Yeah. So it really is. I said earlier we were peanut butter and peanut butter, but on this podcast, in many ways, we're the yin and the yang. We cover the same time period and we both have the same interests and knowledge, but you focus on certain things, then I focus on certain completely different things. So honestly, probably the biggest regret I will have in folding Charting the Territories is that you and I won't get to have these 2-hour conversations once a month. So maybe we can still do that.
We just don't have to.
So now that I've explained my reasons for doing it, I do want to tell our listeners how this is going to work. So first up is this podcast. The final episode of this podcast will almost certainly be later this summer. Right now I'm thinking September, but I'm not positive about that. It might be August, it might be October, but sometime late summer, early fall will be the last podcast episode. Until then, we're going to give you the same quality of work that we've been doing for the last 5 years. So we're covering the women this month. Next month, we're going to be covering another group of the so-called special attractions that we rarely get to talk about on this podcast. And then from there, we're actually going to move to a wrestler whose prime was in the early 70s, who came into his own working as a heel for the first time ever after spending about 6 or so years as a clean-cut boy wonder babyface, was one of the top heels in wrestling in the early 70s, and depending on who you believe, may have actually been in the conversation for a world title run before tragedy struck. And not only ended his career, but sadly ended his life. So that's someone who's pretty important to me and someone who we're going to be talking about on this podcast before we wrap it up. And of course, I somehow have to figure out how to rig a goddamn trivia competition so you can beat Chad Olson. So we're going to figure that out too. Whether that happens next month in Iowa, I'm not sure, but I'm somehow, some way, I'm going to fucking screw him over.
I have confidence in your rigging ability.
It'll be like one of my favorite Dennis Coraluzzo quotes. Not quotes, but what I say about Dennis is it was a game with him. He was going to try and fuck you over, and you just had to figure out how it was going to happen. So, Chad, I'm going to screw you, and it's up to you to figure out how and be prepared and be on defense.
Got to get the Ouija board out and talk to Dennis Coraluzzo.
Yeah. So as for the books, I had announced earlier this year that I was going to be working on and releasing 2 books later this year. I have made, again, another unfortunate decision that it is, in my best interest to stop work on those books and not to release them. I want to be clear, one of them was actually 80% done or so, but just again, I also think it's disingenuous to try and sell new books when there won't be any more after that. I'm the worst capitalist pig ever, apparently.
Yeah, really.
I just don't think it's right to I don't want to spend the time finishing the books, marketing the books, doing all the work involving getting the books released and printed and so on and so forth. So and you know, as I discussed earlier, it seems the best thing for me is to make a clean break from it all. And so that's what I'm going to do. So as for the books that are currently available, I will continue to offer them on the website, chartingtheterritories.com, while supplies last. I have a small amount of most of the books, and I have a fair amount of the last one, the Crockett book. So we're going to keep those up for a while, probably through the end of the year. And as far as Amazon.com, same thing. They will be up until the end of the year. And the reason why I'm doing that is I set Charting the Territories up as a limited liability corporation, an LLC. I file taxes and pay taxes every year. So for tax and financial purposes, it makes sense to fold everything up by the end of the year. Additionally, the website, the commerce package that I have with the website is a yearly renewal, and I think it's in mid-December. So again, it just all lines up to stop selling the books by the end of this year. Between now and then, I have reduced the price of all my books from $21.99 each to $19.99 each. But there will be no further reductions. There will be no sales, no gimmicks. No, I need to unload the last. I made a modest price reduction on the books. If you haven't bought them yet and are interested in seeing the some of my work in print, the books are a great way to do that. If you buy them from chartingtheterritories.com in the continental U.S., I will sign it for you, or you can buy them worldwide off Amazon. Also, you know, doing sales or, you know, deep sales or BOGOs or whatever, honestly, again, worst capitalist ever, I think that would be unfair to my, you know, loyal supporters who purchase the books when they come out and typically pay the full price or get a slight discount for a pre-order. That being said, if you do come to the Tregosthes Hall of Fame induction weekend in Waterloo, Iowa in July and bring cash, you might be able to sweet talk me into a nice deal for you. Now, the Hall of Fame induction weekend takes place from July 17th through the 19th, as I mentioned, in Waterloo, Iowa. This year's honorees include Eric Bischoff, Ron Simmons, Jake Hager, Tank Abbott, David Crockett, Medusa, Tim Hornbaker, and Ron Hutchinson. And I believe Hutchinson will be inducted by Adam Copeland, Edge.
That's a hell of a crew.
Yeah. Also on hand, Gerald Briscoe, JBL, Dan freaking Gable, Sergeant Slaughter, Baron von Roschke, James Beard, Rock Riddle, Les Thatcher, Tom Pritchard, Thunderbolt Patterson, Demolition, Greg Gagne, The Boogeyman, and more. So for further info, search for the George Tregosthes Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame page on Facebook. If my time as a wrestling historian is coming to an end, I do still intend to be a supporter of the Tregosthes Hall of Fame and the museum they have there in Waterloo, Iowa. They are both wonderful, wonderful assets, and I do hope to continue to attend the Hall of Fame induction weekend in years to come. Ooh. So that weekend is coming up next month, but as for this month on the podcast, we will, of course, have all our regular features, including John Plays Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia, This Month I Learned, and stuff John bought me off eBay. But, John, I also wanted to get your thoughts on what I just, you know, the news that I have unleashed on our listeners, which you've known about for a little while. But
I've known about for a little while. It doesn't make my heart ache any less. Like you said, I love what we do. I love automatic friendships, you know, where they just sort of, you know, cause I'm bad at maintaining them in a normal fashion. So this is perfect for me.
John, you'll continue on as the wrestling historian, from outlaws to independence. Put it this way, John, you know, when I talk about how important and how special you are, John, Bo James loves you, and Bo James fucking hates everybody. That is your legacy right there, is you have the Grinch who stole wrestling. his heart has melted for you.
Oh, great. Well, and also with your work, I look at your work as, the podcast and the books is are so important, and I hope people, as well as being regular listeners or purchasers of the books when they came out, I hope now this will get people to buy more of them and download what's available from the website, because I think our what we do, what you do more so with the books and what we do with the podcast, there's so much there that's good reference material that isn't available anywhere else. I mean, yes, a lot of what we talk about and you write about, is we're working on the research of other historians, but so much of the stuff that you've talked about is first time stuff. And I hope
We're
people
trying to take
appreciate
a
that.
very different approach to pro wrestling history than the storytellers that are seem to be more prevalent.
And I hope people appreciate that. And I hope we can that I hope people are able to reference your work and our work for years to
Yeah,
come.
our work, John. Our work, definitely. So before we begin the podcast, I do want to acknowledge a couple of wrestlers who were active in the early 70s who passed away recently, as well as a few other wrestlers who passed away recently. Two wrestlers from the early 70s, Hartford Love and Tony Rocco, both passed away. Hartford Love, probably best known as part of the Love Brothers, along with Reginald Love. And Tony Rocco was one of those guys who just was a journeyman and wrestled everywhere.
Everywhere.
But a few more recent wrestlers from a more recent time who passed away over the last month, Steve McMichael, an indie wrestler from California named Max Justice, who when I worked for Roland Alexander in the late 90s was there. At one point, I think he teamed with Michael Modest. They were doing a Border Patrol gimmick in Southern Cal and maybe even in Tijuana back in the late 90s. And also, of course, Sabu. Shortly before the airing of the Dark Side of the Ring episode on The Sheik, and of course, Sabu was prominently featured in that. And so, so two of those names I mentioned, Sabu and Steve McMichael, they have something in common. And it's two people you don't think would. So, one of the things I enjoyed so much about their work was how sloppy it was. And let's be clear, in the case of one of them, it was intentional. In the case of the other, maybe not so much. But Sabu had this incredibly unique way of selling that stood out whether you were smart or even if you weren't. But it actually worked really well with smart fans because he sold in such a way that, in ECW, that those fans were like, oh my God, I think he's really hurt. And with Steve McMichael, yes, it was probably a little bit of clumsiness, but also again, in a kayfabe sense, if he was a former football star who took up pro wrestling at an advanced age, he's not supposed to be very well polished. It actually fucking worked really well, and he was far better than he had any right to be. Whatever you might think about Logan Paul, same thing. In the case of Logan Paul, they do a lot of rehearsals with him that the wrestlers that were on the road full time didn't get to do. But Steve McMichael was better than he should have been. He had just such charisma, and
Such charisma.
He was just the perfect complement to the Horseman at that time. So we talked about Sabu passing away right before the episode on The Sheik aired Dark Side of the Ring. So now that the latest season of Dark Side of the Ring has finished up, I want to talk about some things from recent episodes. So, John, what were sort of your favorite moments from the last month or so worth of episodes?
Oh, the last few months. My favorite episode, overall was, or to work on, was the Muhammad Hassan episode. I really liked that episode, mostly because I didn't know much about the guy, or I just knew the basics of the story. So I had a blast working on that one, and he's a great dude. So that was really fun. The Daphne one was a rough one.
Yes, it was a rough one to watch too.
Rough on a what? Yeah, and I hope I really it, from and it, I was really worried that I was hoping that they handled everything tastefully as tastefully as you could. And most people who watch it seem to think it was handled pretty well, so I'm thankful for that. Sheik was the Sheik. It was fun going through all the old Sheik footage, and I got we got from the I like to hurt people guys. They got a whole like a DVD's worth of outtakes of behind the scenes footage from like the making of I Like to Hurt People. It was fantastic to watch, to see a lot of like still no footage of the Sheik actually speaking in his actual voice, but some of him sort of behind the scenes in the locker room at Kobo. So that was fun.
Yeah, I also want to talk about just a story about one of the subjects of an episode that you haven't talked about.
Oh, tell
So
me.
shortly after I got in the business, I went to the Super Bowl of Wrestling from Smoky Mountain.
Oh.
I think at this time I wasn't even a manager. I was still just a ring announcer for a local indie in Western North Carolina. But at the show, I ended up backstage. So in a locker room with Terry Gordy, The Undertaker, Kane, who was still wrestling as Unabomber, Curtis Thompson, and another bunch of huge big guys. The most physically imposing guy in the dressing room was Billy Jack Haynes. When he walked past me, he looked dangerous. And this was this was that sort of very brief comeback he had where he was wrestling in Memphis, and this was when Smoky Mountain was doing the interpromotional feud with Memphis, and that's what he was there for. But I mean, like the Undertaker walked by, it's like, hey, there's the Undertaker. And then when Billy Jack walked by, everyone's like quiet and just like looking at this jacked up, scary looking dude. But you mentioned the Daphne
Really?
episode and the Muhammad Hassan episodes. And I gotta be honest, I talked earlier about some of my reasons for folding China territories. I have had somewhat of a love-hate relationship with professional wrestling over the years. I worked as a manager for many years, left the business, thought I was gone forever. It called me back. And then I worked as a manager and I broke my leg. And I thought again, okay, I'm done. And then here's China the territories. So seeing Daphne's episode in particular really hit home for me.
Oof.
We talked last month. I sort of asked you the people that got involved in wrestling did wrestling make them lead to destruction or going down the wrong path, or were they destined there to begin with? And I look at someone like Daphne, despite her having bipolar
Yeah.
issues. Had she not gotten that concussion, would the trajectory of her life change? And it honestly, it hit close to me because it reminded me of my friend Jimmy Rave, indie wrestler down here who had a big run with Ring of Honor, and unfortunately, his addiction took over his life, and he passed away in 2021 when he was just after his 39th birthday.
Oh, man.
And in talking with him, he had had issues with drug use, maybe not necessarily abuse, but definitely use earlier in his life. And when he was wrestling, as his career was taking off, he suffered a pretty significant injury and was introduced to painkillers and the pressure that pro wrestlers have, especially at the independent level, of if you take time off, you are forgotten about, you'll be replaced. Lead them to do what it takes to continue to perform. And unfortunately, Jimmy, lost his battle with addiction and lost his life. And then from there, you see the episode on Muhammad Hussein, on Mark Capani. And at the end of the episode, Jim Cornette said it best. He said, Mark is far better off having gotten out of this fucking business. And,
You look at so many of the guys who are on that roster when he was there, and where
So
they
we've talked
in
about
the
how we
past.
try and focus on this podcast, we try and focus on the wrestlers who seem to have left wrestling and had a productive life. Len Rossi, the list goes on and on and on. And seeing how Hassan was able to get out unscathed, especially coming on the heels of the episode with Daphne, it's just it's just
Needed that one.
it's sometimes difficult to cover this business because it has a seedy underbelly, to say the least, and always has, and no matter how much we try and change that, it probably always will.
That's one of the reasons why that episode was one of my favorites to work on, because it did have a happy ending, and he's a great guy.
It did. So congratulations to Mark Capani for getting out of this fucking business.
Yes.
So we'll move now to stuff John bought me off eBay. So just a reminder to our listeners, John is authorized to spend up to or approximately $50 of my money buying me stuff off eBay. And this time it was Betty Nikolai centric. Also want to address, I have almost certainly mispronounced her last name in the past on episodes of this podcast. And in fact, how I learned that the correct pronunciation is Betty Nikolai is from a clip, some YouTube footage that you uploaded about a year ago. There's a match that's from, I think, Heart of America TV, and there's a match between her and Jean Antone. And so hearing her introduced, they pronounce her last name, which is spelled Nicci, the same way that we would pronounce Nikolai Volkov.
Yep.
So the two items you sent me, first off is a little, I don't know if it's a 3x5. I don't have my tape measure out, but a, you know, a small photo of Betty Nikolai, and then a magazine. And this magazine was the October 1971 issue of Wrestling Review.
Ooh, baby.
And these magazines, unlike what we refer to as the Apter mags, which weren't Apter mags in the early 70s, but these magazines covered a much wider range of areas than London Publishing or whatever we would call them. So in this magazine, there's articles on wrestling in Mississippi, wrestling in Europe, in the UK. There's an article on rising star Jimmy Valiant, with Valiant spelled V-A-L-I-E-N-T, which may have been how he spelled it back then. I know originally he worked some as Jim or John Valen, V-A-L-E-N, but I think it was a few years before they came up with V-A-L-I-A-N-T. There's also an article on the triumvirate heel entourage of The Claw, Rock Rogowski, and Ox Baker. This would have been working for the Dusicks in Nebraska. And it's interesting to note that the time those three were a trio was early 1971, because what got them all together was a legitimate broken leg suffered by The Claw that led to him becoming a manager. And being put together with Rogowski, later Ole Anderson, and Ox Baker. So, and we've talked about this in the past, the cover date of these magazines, October, and this one was October 1971, in all likelihood, the magazine was on newsstands several months prior to that, and further, the articles in it were written perhaps a couple of months or even more before that. So while this magazine has a cover date of October 71, much of the content in there is from several months earlier. To wit, the reason you sent me this magazine, there's an article on Betty Nikolai, and it talks about her feud with Patty O'Hara. Patty O'Hara's last documented match against Betty Nikolai was August 1970. In fact, O'Hara seems to have finished her brief wrestling career by the summer of 1971. So that article might have been written, you know, up to a year earlier. And John, do you know who wrote that article on Betty Nikolai and Patty O'Hara?
I'm going to guess Tom Burke.
You are close. The answer is Dave Brzezinski, who was recently featured on the Dark Side episode about the Sheik.
One of my favorite criticisms of the Sheik episode was like, I really wish they would have got Supermouth Dave Drayson to be in this episode.
And John, fair enough. Why is that funny?
Because that's Dave Brzezinski.
There you go. Yes. So the magazine is interesting. There's also what is purported to be a picture of a young Jerry Lawler in a match. You can't see his face from the build. I'm not convinced that it's, I mean, size-wise, it's about right. He looks a little pudgier than I remember young Jerry Lawler to be. So I'll post a picture of it on Blue Sky and on Facebook, see if any of our listeners have thoughts. But it's very rare to see, you know, a rookie a photo of a rookie Jerry Lawler. It really wasn't until his big run a couple of years later with Jim White that we start seeing photos of him.
Yeah.
So obviously these two were based on the primary subject of this month's podcast, Betty Nicolai. Any interesting bidding wars going on over these items, or was it?
No, these are just straight up Betty Nicolai search. Boom, boom, boom.
Boom, the, boom, boom, because there's two.
The card there, I believe, is one of those produced by Boyd Pierce, I believe. I think those are all his. And I used to sell those in programs, magazines, and at the old gimmick table there.
Yeah, you see in a lot of the old programs, they have lists, a mail-in order form for 8x10s or photos of your favorite wrestlers.
Yeah, I haven't found like a checklist or anything for these, but I have about 200 of them the last time I counted. So, and I would assume they're more, but I'm searching for a Ernie Ladd Tom Jones combo one. If anybody has that, let me know. I'll pay you handsomely.
Yeah, so apparently those are hard to find. You might say they're unusual.
Especially that. Yes.
So for the first time, something involving Tom Jones is not unusual.
Yes, exactly.
I mentioned that we very rarely have gotten the opportunity to talk about women's wrestling. In fact, when we run down the rosters of each territory, I don't include the women. And so to understand why we don't do that and to truly understand women's roles in pro wrestling in the early 70s, we need to probably go back a little further and talk about the Mildred Burke era and,
yeah,
you know, how that ended and sort of the transition from that into what we have in the 1970s. And John, you're sort of better equipped to discuss that than I. So let's talk about women's wrestling, from a larger period of time.
Yeah, I'll try to keep this as brief as possible. Mildred Burke, huge, 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 huge. I can't say huge enough. Huge star from the mid 30s to the early 50s. To put her, to put it in the proper historical perspective, probably wasn't a female in wrestling as popular as her until we get into like the Sonny and Sable era, who weren't even. I mean, they wrestled, but it's a different kind of wrestling altogether. One of the top draws in the country for quite a few years.
Yep.
I don't know how exactly we quantify her on a list or anything, but I feel confident throwing her out as a top 10 draw from like 1938 to 1944 or whenever. I know there are a couple of years where the number of cards that she headlined that drew over 10,000 people or more was fourth overall behind like Lundos and Wild Bill Longson and guys like that. There's a few years where she finished in the top 10 of the AP's Female Athlete of the Year polling.
Wow.
And despite what Luthez thought of women's wrestling, Mildred Burke, she could go. She could shoot. She was a tough woman. You know, there's an infamous match with June Byers where she, gets her dislocates her knee 15 minutes into the match, slaps it back in, and wrestles another 5 minutes in what was a legit fight. You know, she could handle herself in that regard. She understood the theatrical aspects of pro wrestling, and she also recognized that a portion of the men that were there watching might not be diehard fans of the grappling arts, but just want to see scantily clad women roll around, and was able to capitalize on that as well. She understood the whole thing very, very well. So the transition from the Mildred Burke era to what we'd call the Moolah era, or the era of women as special attractions, was a slow one. If you want to nail down a specific match or date, you could look at that Mildred Burke versus June Byers shoot match from August 54 as the beginning of the end. It was a slow process, and a lot of that transition has to do with Billy Wolf, who was also Mildred Burke's husband for a while. Billy Wolf was an awful, 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 awful human being, as awful of a human being as...
In a business populated with awful human beings, Billy Wolf stood head and shoulders.
Yeah. I haven't seen Queen of the Ring yet, but I bet...
Neither have I.
I bet however much of a villain as he is portrayed in that movie, I would bet that he's 100 times worse. So make that long story short, their personal and professional relationships both go horribly sideways. More so than you can imagine. Wolf is essentially able to get Burke blackballed by the NWA Billy Wolf passes away in 1961. June Byers, his new favorite there, continues as women's champ until a car accident ends her career in 1964. Where Moolah comes in, we go back a few years to 1956, where she's slave girl Moolah. She wins a Jack Pfeffer promoted tournament and becomes champion of a booking office run by Buddy Lee. Buddy Lee, who would later promote the UWA with Luthez in the mid-70s. Over the course of the next few years, Buddy Lee's influence grows. Billy Wolf's diminishes, as does his reputation, because, as I said, he was an awful, awful man and did awful, awful things. And once he dies, Byers retires. Buddy Lee becomes more of the power broker for women's wrestling, but eventually decides to move into music promotion because there was more money. And then Moolah takes over and was in charge for decades. And over the course of that, you know, 10 years, mid-50s to mid-60s, women's wrestling made that shift from the Mildred Burke era, where they were main eventers or co-main eventers, to the Moolah era, where they were, you know, more attractions, short-term attractions. That's how we get to where we are, basically.
And so when we say special attractions, you know, typically, as we've discussed on this podcast, when a wrestler would go to a territory, they would stay there for at least a few months, and typically, you know, closer to 6 to 8 months. And of course, some stayed longer than that. With the special attractions, they were typically brought in for 1 or 2 weeks at a time. And this probably depends on the size of the territory and how many towns they ran. If they were running, you know, a solid 2 or even 3 shows a night, they'd probably be there for 2 weeks so they could hit all the important towns at least once. If it's a one show a night territory like Vancouver typically was, they might just be in for 1 week. And more often than not, you see a crew of 4 women wrestlers and all go to a territory for 1 or 2 weeks at a time and then go somewhere else. And the which 4 it was constantly shuffled. So the women, you know, the 3 women that you go to, you know, Texas with, you might then, you know, 2 weeks later be with 3 completely different women in Florida or somewhere else, for example. Now, Moolah's had a troop of wrestlers. The exact number of wrestlers under her control probably varied greatly, and also varied greatly in skill and how often they were booked. There are quite a few that only seem to show up a handful of times in the WWF, so that they might have been more along the lines of students slash trainees that were still in progress that didn't necessarily graduate. But at any given time, there's probably a couple of troops of Moolah's crew out and about somewhere. And when they're not booked somewhere, they do often pop up on WWF cards. Even though I think Moolah was based in South Carolina, they still worked more often for McMahon than for anywhere else. And that was sort of their home base. And so because of this, and when the women, you know, go to a territory, they spend 2 weeks wrestling each other every night. It's not like the men in the territory where there's, you know, up, you know, could be 2 dozen of them. And every single night of the week, a wrestler is facing different wrestlers. Here, if there's 4 women in a territory, invariably, most of the time, they are wrestling in a tag match every night. Sometimes they may be split off into 2 singles matches, but or some mixed tags, but usually the women wrestle each other the whole time they're there. So because of that, their spot rating for that 2 week run in a territory would be the same. If they're all in the same match every night, their spot rating would be the same. Now, on occasion, you might have Moolah in a, you know, defending the ladies world championship in a high profile singles match. So I think if you calculated the spot ratings for the women over a very long period of time, Moolah would definitely be ahead of all the others. But I also think all the others would be bunched up together. And part of me feels that's by design. I think it's pretty clear that Moolah didn't want any of the women to necessarily become stars. So when she's defending her title, it's not against someone who's billed as the number one contender in the nation. It is someone who maybe pinned her in a tag match the previous week or won a battle royal, or and it's a rotating cast of challengers. It's not like she consistently had one over the other. Now, some of them, like Susan Green or even Vicki Williams and Tony Rose, do seem to have been booked more frequently out to different territories than others. So truly, if I wanted to rank the women wrestlers in the 1970s by what I perceived was their, much in the same way I rank the male wrestlers by a spot rating, I would use some combination of how often they were booked out to different territories and how many different territories they worked in. So I think that's a sign of how good they were as a wrestler, was how many different places they were able to work and how often they got booked. So another question is, we talk about the special attractions. Why did the territories have the special attractions? If they're doing well enough on their own, why do they feel the need to bring in women or midgets or bears or alligators or what have you? And the answer, again, without hard numbers and evidence, it's hard to say for a fact, but it sure seems like they drew. And not only did they draw more fans than when they're not on the card, but they seem to draw fans that weren't typically house show attending, ticket buying fans. So when it comes to the midgets, who we'll talk about next month, when I went through the state of Washington's Athletic Commission records, they actually broke down ticket sales by adults and by kids for every house show.
Wow.
And
that's cool.
When the midgets were booked, because the word on the street or the prevailing wisdom, you know, that's been passed down was that the midgets drew kids. When we look at the data from the Washington Athletic Commission, this is true. They absolutely drew a higher percentage of kids' tickets were sold when the midgets were in town than when they weren't. And I think it's fair to say the same thing happened with the women wrestlers. They drew a different set of fans that weren't normally attending. Now, as you alluded to earlier, they are probably guys that want to see, not even necessarily scantily clad. Certainly by today's standards, you look at what the women wore in these days, they're not scantily clad. But again, just seeing women showing some skin and rolling around the ring with one another. Again, what I will say, I am so glad that this is no longer the case and that women's wrestling is treated so much differently now than it was then. And as I've mentioned on this podcast before, a large part of that needs to be given credit needs to be given to Kathy Carino and Dave Prazak for what they did to elevate women's wrestling and to legitimize it as a sport. But we also, again, if the point of being a wrestling historian is to accurately depict how wrestling was in this era, it's probably fair to say that the women's matches were seen as a little eye candy for some of the guys, and I really think now again Moolah was Moolah got coverage in the magazines and this and that, but by and large the other women, I it's really hard to see them as draws. I don't think anyone said, oh, wow, Vicki Williams is coming to town next week, as much as they said, oh, the women are coming to town next week.
Yeah.
So, again, it's really hard to document how well these women were perceived, what their star power may have been, because A, they were treated as an ensemble, as a special attraction, and B, Fabulous Moolah may have intentionally held her wrestlers down to make sure she was positioned as the star. So we're going to talk about Moolah's crew first, and then talk about some of the other women wrestlers that were active in this era. So, of course, the leader of Moolah's troupe was the Fabulous Moolah. The rest of these wrestlers, and these were the ones with the who were booked the most in the early 70s, and I'm going to list them in alphabetical order. So first up is Debbie Johnson, followed by Donna Christianello.
She lived with Moolah for 35 years, which, and I think she was married too, which is even, I don't know how that whole situation worked out, which I think is the longest anyone had lived with Moolah aside from maybe Diamond Lil. She may have a few years on Donna Christianello, and Moolah served as the matron of honor at Donna's wedding.
Next up is Dottie Downs, who's also known as Dorothy Downs, and she was the mother of Debbie Johnson. Next up is Jan Sheridan, followed by Joyce Grable. Now, this was the second wrestler to be billed under the name Joyce Grable. The first was Joyce Fowler, who also used the ring name Barbara Nichols and was married to George Becker. This Joyce Grable, the second Joyce Grable, turned pro in 1972. Her real name was Betty Elizabeth Murphy, and she was reportedly trained by Judy Grable as well as by Moolah. Next up is a woman who, along with Sandy Parker, was probably one of the two most active black women wrestlers in the early 70s, and that is Lily Thomas. And next up is Paula Kay.
Prior to becoming a pro wrestler, Paula Kay Collier was in the Air Force. And after wrestling, she worked for the South Carolina Department of Transportation for nearly 30 years.
Wow, that's pretty badass.
Yeah.
Next up, we have Peggy Patterson, who also would occasionally wrestle under a mask as White Venus. Next up is Sharon Joye, spelled J-O-Y-E. And Sharon's brother was wrestler slash manager Jim Kent, who as a manager had one of my favorite non-body part nicknames, which was Cashbox.
Ah, Cashbox hit.
next on the list is Susan Green.
Susan Green started wrestling for Joe Blanchard at just 15 years old.
So there's a lot of that in women's wrestling in this era. A lot of them started really ickily this, young.
This gets like less icky, I think. Maybe. I don't know. But before beginning her training, Joe Blanchard insisted that she get her wrestling license. And Susan's parents actually had to be interviewed by the then governor of Texas, John Connally, who 6 years earlier was seated in front of JFK when he was assassinated. And Connally had to make sure that she wasn't being forced into child labor. So he interviewed her and her parents separately together and eventually approved the request.
This reminds me of the day of Priscilla Kelly's wrestling debut. Priscilla Kelly, better known as Gigi Dolin in NXT, who was recently released. So Priscilla Kelly, on the day of what was to be her debut match on an indie show in Georgia, the promoter found out that she was not 18 yet and had to scramble to print up some sort of document that got her mom to sign it. Literally, minutes before the match. Next up was Tippi Wells, and then Toni Rose and Vicky Williams. Now, Toni Rose has a little over 1,200 documented matches on WrestlingData.com, and Vicky Williams has just over 1,000. They are each other's most frequent opponent, with 294 known instances of them being on opposite sides of the ring.
Wow.
So aside from Moolah's troupe, there's another very small group based in Kansas and Missouri. And the most prevalent woman in this group was Betty Nicolai. But also part of this little crew was Jean Antone.
Jean Antone in November 1961. Jean Antone married Bobby Joe McLean in the ring.
Yeah.
In Laurel, Mississippi.
And then had a match that she won later that night.
And had a match and beat Ann Laverne.
Yeah.
Apparently, Bobby Joe did not approve of this wrestling lifestyle, and they divorced after a few years.
Did they divorce in the ring, too?
No,
has that ever been done?
There's some TV. There's some TV for you.
Next up is Kay Noble.
Kay Noble. Very tough lady. You talked about Tom Andrews earlier.
Yep.
The Claw and his broken leg. He's got a great story. About his broken leg, and he was managing, seconding Ox Baker, whatever you want to call it. Ox, as he was known to do, got a lot of heat, too much heat, and the crowd was about to riot. So Ox, knowing what that looks like, runs to the locker room, leaves Tom Andrews at ringside on crutches to fend for himself. Who comes to the rescue? Not one of the half dozen men in the locker room. Kay Noble comes out. Andrew says she came out, just started swinging at guys, knocking dudes on their butts, and just cleared a path for him to hobble his way back to the locker room.
Man, that's great. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Another wrestler briefly was part of this crew was Rhonda Davis, who also wrestled under the names Rhonda Jean and Pat Davis. We also have Sandy Partlow. And then, additionally, Barbara Galento spent some time here in the early 1970s. Barbara was the real-life daughter of Mario Galento. They teamed up occasionally in mixed tags, and in fact, their first matches together were against another father-daughter team, Jack and JoJo Welch of the sprawling Welch slash Fuller slash Field slash Golden slash Hatfield clan.
Huh. I've seen a Rhonda Galento also build. Is that, could that be Rhonda Davis?
I don't know. I it could be. It
I
could
just,
be.
I just remember reading
but I'm not sure. So now going back to Betty Nicolai, she began her wrestling career in 1963, just after she turned 20. But a few years prior, she was involved in what sounds like a wild automobile accident that probably saw her take the craziest bump of her life.
Oh, my God.
So, John, let's talk about this article. This is from the, and of course, I will post this on Blue Sky. You can see me at algetz.bsky.social. This is from the May 3rd, 1959 edition of the Kansas City Star.
Yes, it's terrifying. It's got photos, a terrifying headline, several terrifying headlines. Car vaults 75 feet off bridge into Kaw River. Fatal plunge by car. This is like a Bob Luce program here. Girl drowns after vehicle goes off 23rd Street Viaduct into Kaw River. Three others saved. Survivors aided by a railroad worker who swims into stream. Quote, traveling too fast, unquote. So it's basically, we've got a motor car carrying four teenage girls hurtled over a railing on the 23rd Street Viaduct last night and plunged 75 feet into the Kaw River below. One girl drowned, but the others reached shore safely, aided by a young railroad worker. The car, which was westbound, went off the south side of the span of the river, about 100 feet west of the state line. The dead girl was identified by her companions as Mrs. Nancy Carolyn Vogler, 18 years old, of 3224 East 8th Street. The girl had been married to a serviceman now overseas only a few weeks, and I was planning to join him in Europe soon. Ugh. Yeah, the injured, Mary Rose Figgins, 14, of 701 Woodland Avenue, left wrist fracture and abdominal injuries, taken to St. Margaret's Hospital. Betty Jo Nicolai, just 15 years old, here she is, of 1201 Admiral Boulevard, left arm, left wrist fracture, also at St. Margaret's. Mary Kay DePriest, 16, severe back injury, possible fractures of both ankles. Accident occurred about 8:30 o'clock, and apparently the guy, this railroad worker, just found like a dead tree limb lying on the bank, dove into the river in the direction of the two girls.
Well, and, so he ran across several sets of tracks, climbed a 5-foot flood wall, and ran about 40 feet down a steep embankment.
Oh yeah,
that's to the water's edge, and then found a dead tree limb and dove into the river.
Yeah, I think he rescued the other two. I think Nicolai, Betty, I think apparently she was thrown, right, a convertible.
Yeah, so they were in an open convertible, yeah. And I guess as it's flying in the air, she goes flying out of the car.
Yeah, so she a big bump, and she was able to swim partway to the bank when Connors came back, and yeah. This is just a crazy, crazy story.
It is a crazy story. So what's really funny is they do later on say as the police showed up, an unidentified girl at the scene was shouting to Betty Nicolai, don't say anything. Apparently she was in another car. So again, whether they were drag racing or whatever it was, this seems to be what happened. But yes, it appears they were going faster than they should have given where they were at, and ended up in the river. And unfortunately, one young girl drowned, but Betty Nicolai survived, and a few years later got into professional wrestling.
Yes.
Now, going back to Betty Nicolai in the ring and the local crew of wrestlers based out of Canvas, this doesn't appear to have necessarily been a rival crew of Moolah's troupe so much as just two separate groups of women wrestlers. Because Nicolai, Antone, and the others were based in the central U.S., they were most often seen in Heart of America and neighboring adjacent territories, whereas Moolah's crew worked really all over the place, all over the U.S. and Canada, but with a heavy emphasis, as I mentioned, on the northeastern U.S. I don't think there were any exclusivity deals, i.e. if a territory booked Moolah's crew, they couldn't later bring in Nikolai and Gene Antone, or vice versa, but they usually weren't in the same place at the same time. There are, however, exceptions to that rule. In August 1971, Betty Nikolai and Fabulous Moolah wrestled at least three singles matches against one another in Southern California, including on the August 27th show at the LA Coliseum that was headlined by Blassie Tolis. So again, even though they're with different troops, they're brought in to wrestle against one another. And maybe that was seen as something unique even for the women wrestlers. These were two wrestlers who you never saw wrestle against one another. So maybe that's why LaBelle wanted to do it, particularly for the big show at the Coliseum.
Yeah, I've only seen... I do want to come back to the exclusivity thing.
Okay.
I have a counterpoint to your point.
Go for it.
So we can search. So I did find one... wasn't sure where to talk about that. I just have this highlighted. I found this interview. Not to get too far off track, but one of the things that Betty Nikolai was known for was having sort of a battle publicity sort of thing with the New York State Athletic Commission.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Regarding women not being to wrestle in Madison Square Garden,
she
et cetera,
was very
made the
vocal.
Papers.
Yeah, she was very vocal and wanted to get that overturned. However.
And it ended with... And it made the papers. Her and Penny Banner, I think, testifying in front of a panel where they're asking them questions like, "Do you think you're a man?" And the ban, of course, eventually lifted, but Betty never competed in the Garden or even New York State, as she never applied for a license.
Right. I thought, didn't she maybe have one match in Albany, New York, or something? I could be very wrong about that.
I couldn't find anything,
but definitely not in the Garden. And the big thing that was, of course, the big push.
And what I found an interview, Scott Teal interviewing Susan Green
okay.
In 2016. And he asked her, "When did you first hear about the girls being allowed to wrestle in New York?" Susan Green says, "A few days before Moolah and Vicki Williams went up there, Moolah told us we finally beat the Athletic Commission. But none of us remembered going to Vince. After the fact, I learned that Penny Banner and Betty Nikolai were the two that actually went before the commission to get us in. Vince McMahon Sr. flew them up a number of times for the hearings. They weren't Moolah's girls, but Sr. had said that the ones that looked soft enough and prim enough to go before the commission were too young, and Moolah looked too rough. Tony Rose and Donna Cristinello would have been the two people Moolah could have sent with Vince's approval. Tony looked the part, but Moolah, at that time, had started backing away from using her." So then Scott Teal says, "Penny was instrumental in convincing the commission to allow girls to wrestle in New York. Why didn't she wrestle there afterwards?" Susan Green says, "I talked to Penny a number of times and asked her about it. She said, I was in the process of backing away and retiring, so I wasn't interested in wrestling, but I wanted to see the girl wrestlers go on." Scott Teal asks about Betty Nikolai, and Susan Green says, "Vince wouldn't book her because Moolah wouldn't let her wrestle any of us."
Okay, so perhaps perhaps Moolah's stroke with the Mayans was so strong that she was able to... not allow others in, but what I'm referring to, I'm saying, the McGurk territory or Georgia or, Northern California, it sure seems like they were free to at different times book wrestlers from a different crew. So again, if they're bringing in wrestlers 2 to 3 times a year, maybe they didn't always want Moolah's crew because they knew Moolah was always going to be one of them. So maybe they wanted to have not just women wrestlers, but a variety of them. So would book Moolah's crew twice a year and then Nikolai's group once.
Yep.
Now, even aside from these two troops of women wrestlers, there were a number of women who were based in other areas, and typically they wrestled mainly for the territory closest to them, or on some occasions, the territory their husband was based out of, and perhaps some neighboring areas as well. And the most well-known of these were, first off, someone you just talked about, Penny Banner, who was married to Johnny Weaver and spent a good part of her career primarily wrestling for Crockett. Next is Ma Bass, the former Mae Weston. And then in the Tennessee area, Cora Combs.
Cora Combs was an actual coal miner's daughter from Hazard, Kentucky. Prior to getting into the wrestling business, her first love was music, and she played the bass fiddle, actually moved to Nashville and joined a music group called the Trail Riders.
Next up is Bonnie Watson. Now, Bonnie wrestled for over 20 years, though after she married Tampa-based referee Sue Schwartz, she wrestled almost exclusively in Florida and typically having no more than 50 matches a year. In the early 70s, another female wrestler that had a very brief clash, brush with fame and notoriety and appeared in numerous places was Vivian Vachon.
Mm.
And of course, John, the impetus for that was?
Well, probably the Wrestling Queen movie.
Yeah.
A lot. And then she, like you said, relatively short career compared to a lot of these other women who had like 20, 25-year careers. Her full-time career, I think, was basically over by the same time the documentary came out.
Yeah. They filmed footage of her wrestling in all different, in many different territories, yeah, often against a different opponent every night, which again was unusual for the women wrestlers. But just to get a whole bunch of footage the majority of which, was not in the movie at all. But Vivian, of course, there was a, you mentioned some of that the wrestlers with Moolah's troupe that were considered soft or feminine looking were on the young side.
Yeah.
So Vivian was probably, she was in her very early 20s at the time, but she was an adult and she certainly, was a very attractive woman, especially compared to many of the other women wrestlers of this era.
Oh, she looked great.
Yeah.
Was she, I know she was trained by Moolah, but was this during this time, was Moolah still booking her out or was she doing her own thing?
This I don't know because it seems like this was something arranged, might've even been arranged by the movie producers.
Huh.
So I don't know if they necessarily had to go through Moolah or somebody. And then after that, I think she seems to have been able, been almost a free agent of sorts. And I don't know if she's calling her own shots or if she's having, Butcher or Mad Dog assisting her. But she does seem to be going places that you don't normally see, the women wrestlers go. And she's not going with a regular opponent or a regular troupe.
Yeah. You see her sort of like if she's in the Northeast or the Carolinas, you see the Moolah crew. But then you'll see her in the Midwest or working for Vern and it'll be against like Kay Noble or Betty Nicolai or Jean Antone. And then she's in Texas and she's working against Fifi LaVerne.
Yeah. So she, for a brief period of time, seemed to, be able to call her shots and was probably considered someone with legitimate star potential and perhaps even, could usher in an era similar to the Burke, the Mildred Burke era.
Yeah.
That did not transpire. So there's a little bit of wrestling trivia for you.
Uh-oh.
And when I say trivia, is like when Eric Bischoff used to say 2-minute warning or 3-minute warning on Raw all those years ago. It signals what's about to come, and that is John Plays Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia. This month, John, you will once again be squaring off with ChatGPT.
It's getting smarter every month.
Yeah, it is. Last month, we learned that ChatGPT can answer true-false questions. So we will proceed with that knowledge this month. Also, before we begin, I do want to reiterate that this game was released in 1987. Mm. So, John, we're going to start with question number one.
Okay.
Question number one. Who managed the interns?
I would go with Dr. Ken Ramey.
All right, John has answered Dr. Ken Ramey. So ChatGPT, at first, when I typed that in verbatim, it responded with a question of its own. It asked me, could you clarify which organization, company, or context you're referring to? That will help me give you an accurate answer. And I consider that a fair question to ask for. So okay. I typed in pro wrestling and it responded with Dr. Ken Ramey. And the answer is Dr. Ken Ramey. So both John and ChatGPT got it right. If you want to say ChatGPT needed a little Iggy and maybe it shouldn't count as a full, correct answer, maybe we'll do that. Maybe if it's tied, John, you'll win the tiebreaker if you don't ask any follow-up questions.
I'll take it up with the Athletic Commission.
There you go. The Trivia Athletic Commission. Question number two. Name the match where other wrestlers surround the ring with leather straps.
This one always gets me. The lumberjack match?
All right, John has answered lumberjack match. ChatGPT answered lumberjack strap match.
Lumberjack strap match.
The correct answer, in according to Gordon Solie's wrestling trivia game, Canadian lumberjack match. That's a pretty obscure one to me. I would have gotten that wrong. I would have gone with lumberjack strap match. However, both John and ChatGPT got this one incorrect, so it is still tied at one each.
Cool.
Moving on to question number three, and I've got a little note here. The game card lists two possible answers for this one.
Oh.
I will allow you to name two, and you only need to get one of them right. And the same applies to ChatGPT.
Okay.
Because it the question asks for the name of a wrestler, but then it gives two answers. So the question is, which wrestler is noted for a mysterious green mist that he sprays in opponents' eyes?
I would go with, say, 1987. I'll go with Great Kabuki.
And now you know why I sort of hit that 1987 earlier, because if I hadn't said that, you probably would have guessed one of the responses that ChatGPT said, and that was Great Muta. So, John, your answer is Great Kabuki. ChatGPT listed four wrestlers: Great Muta, Great Kabuki, Tajiri, and Asuka.
In recent years,
as part of her heel run, was using it. The correct answer, the answer on the trivia card, it says Kendo Nagasaki or the Great Kabuki.
Okay.
So once again, both John and ChatGPT got it right. So we're still tied and we're going into the fourth and final question. True or false?
Oh boy.
The question on Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia Game is true or false. TV commentator Gordon Solie was made an honorary life member in the Florida Sheriff's Association for his many philanthropic contributions.
I'm going to go with true.
So you don't think Gordon Solie would put some lie about his career achievements? So you think it's true?
I think it's true.
ChatGPT said it was true, but I want to note, it took ChatGPT a long time to answer this one. I don't think it was the 30-second, time limit I used to have, but it did some thinking, and it said true.
Okay.
And the correct answer, of course, in Gordon Solie's trivia game, he's going to put himself over. The answer is true, which means that, John, you tied with ChatGPT, which means you are as smart as the collective amount of information on the internet.
Which the computer has not yet taken my job.
No, the computer has not yet taken your job, Daddy.
I wonder if someone had actually gone through all of the Gordon Solie cards and entered them.
I don't know if they've gone through all of them, but there are some people that have tried to list the ones that are incorrect. If that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, I wonder if there's, I wonder where he's, where we're pulling from, I guess. Interesting.
So back to women's wrestling in the early 1970s. I mentioned earlier, it's hard to rank the women wrestlers in the same way that we rank the male wrestlers by using their spot rating, because most of them had very similar spot ratings due to the fact they're always wrestling against each other. By and large, though, I will say the spot rating for these women wrestlers was around a 0.6, between a 0.6 and a 0.65. So, which puts them in the lower end of the upper mid-carder category. And that sort of makes sense when you look at the advertisements, because they are often given more, what I'll say, real estate in a newspaper ad than other matches. They might include photos of the women, because again, they're looking for eye candy. But they're also, they're billed as special attractions, but it's also usually clearly noted that they're not the main event. Even if they're the top listing on the rundown of the card, they're still not designated as the main event. And it varies from territory to territory, but some territories, as a rule of thumb, had the women's match on first. Some of them, even if it wasn't billed as the main event, would put it on last. But by and large, they put it in the upper half of the cards, but the lower part of the upper half of the cards. So again, in using our spot rating, how I've always said it was, we list, you know, the matches in their perceived order of importance. And so even if the top billed thing in an ad in the newspaper is, you know, Tony Rose versus, you know, Donna Christianello, it's clear that there's another main event, which is based on a television angle that might be for a title or might be a stipulation match, that is the most important thing happening that night. But at the same time, the women's match is an important thing because it's a unique thing. And it's something that, again, is drawing fans that don't normally attend house shows. And the same thing with the little persons, with the midgets. Their spot rating, same thing, is around a 0.6 to a 0.65. And the leader of their troop, Lord Littlebrook, probably had a slightly higher spot rating than the others, just like Moolah probably had a higher spot rating than the others, because occasionally they put themselves in the higher profile singles matches. Littlebrook every now and then would dust off a title belt called the World's Midget title that he would defend. But the same, just like we can't, it's just like it's hard to quantify them and rank them by spot rating. Same thing goes with trying to quantify feuds. Again, if four women are wrestling against one another in tag matches every night and it's the same teams, that's not really a feud. And when they're in a territory, they typically only wrestle in each market once. Like I said, even if they're in a territory for 2 weeks, they'll hit each town once. Now, every now and then, you might have Moolah defending her title at a big show or in a second week in the same market, and perhaps she got pinned in a tag match the week before to set up the title match. Every now and then, you see a battle royal where the winner gets a shot later in the card against Moolah. But that's about it as far as angles go. And again, really, the draw is not that, this woman who did this last week is now going to get her revenge. It's, there's women wrestling. I would like to see women wrestling.
I've seen, when we were talking about Moolah and Betty Nicolai earlier, I found one other match of theirs from, I think, Sioux City, Iowa, 1967, which was a rare example of what you see a lot with Moolah. Is matches, you'll just have like a random women's match, and you know, underneath the women's match, you know, winner to get a title shot at Moolah, you know, which, you know, and more often than not, that match does not happen. It seems like it's more just a promotional thing to put some stakes into a match that might not have any stakes.
Maybe they didn't specifically say the winner gets the match at Moolah next week in this town. They're just
eventually.
Saying,
yeah, there's no date.
Somewhere down the road in another town.
Yeah.
So as a general rule of thumb, there aren't feuds with angles between these women wrestlers. But of course, every rule has an exception. And here I do want to talk about Gulf Coast Wrestling in 1970, in the early 70s, with the fabulous Moolah and her feud with Ma Bass.
Oh, baby.
So Ma Bass was a former woman wrestler. I think at this point in time, she's 50 or 51. So she is a valet for Don and Ron Bass. And they build to an angle where Ma is hitting the men with her purse or whatever, and sometimes on occasion even doing spots with the guys. And this builds to Moolah being brought in to be a part of six-man intergender, you know, six-person mixed tags with the Bass clan against two male wrestlers and Moolah. And this splits off into some singles matches with Moolah and Ma Bass that are very clearly billed as main events in some of the towns in Gulf Coast and very clearly draw above average crowds. So again, every rule has an exception. And so here we do see Mula and Ma Bass being booked into a typical, you know, by a typical wrestling feud with angles and things at stake. I think it culminated in a loser leave town match.
Yeah, I think they did like a blow off cage match.
They might,
busted open, I think.
Yeah. You're right. Because I've seen photos of that. Of the blow.
I might be wrong. And I might just have like the dates mixed up, but I think the feud was so successful that they've sort of ran it back twice.
Yes.
Which is like wild to think about, you know? Like,
yeah. It became kind of like Bobby Shane's run in Gulf Coast. He left such an impression that, you know, they kept bringing him back. So the same thing here. So, Betty Nicolai and Gene Antone wrestled against one another many, many times, particularly in Heart of America where they were based. But by and large, it's, you know, they just show up in one market for wrestle each other, and then they'll be sent to other places and won't be brought back to that same market for a few months or so. But again, there are exceptions to the rule. So in Great Bend, Kansas, which was run monthly, they had matches in two consecutive months in 1972, with the second being a Texas death match.
Wow.
So while we don't have results for the shows in Great Bend, it stands to reason that the first match likely had a screwy or inconclusive finish to set up a Texas Death rematch the following month. Now in 1973, they also had a Texas Death match in Cedar Rapids, but they hadn't been in Cedar Rapids for 5 months prior.
Hmm.
So there wasn't an angle to set it up. And the same thing happened in Quincy, Illinois. They just had a Texas death match. Hmm. However, in Quincy, a month later, they were booked in a boxing match.
Yeah.
So they had a Texas death match and then a boxing match. And in a few other towns, they also had boxing matches. So again, this is the sort of thing. Again, it's not a storyline. It's not an angle, but it's okay. Every few months we have Nicolai and Antone wrestle one another. What can we do this time around to be a little different? And so it's a boxing match. They would also have occasional matches for a title, which was not consistently referred to by the same name. In newspaper ads, you see sometimes it's the girls' title, sometimes it's the ladies' title, sometimes it's the women's title, and sometimes it's called the Kansas State girls' or women's or ladies' title.
Hmm.
The lineage of this title is very unclear and likely was not treated as something that fans were constantly updated on. As I like to say, this title was even less legitimate than most other professional wrestling titles. Nicolai and Antone were featured in an article in the May 1921, 1972 newspaper, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, entitled Glamour Girls of Grunt and Groan. I'll post images of the article of Blue Sky and Facebook. But John, what were some of the more interesting things that you found in this arc?
I love the photos of the two of them. Mm-hmm. like Betty Nicolai looking like sweet and demure, sitting there with her hands folded, looking up, and Gene Antone looking like she's like an angry substitute teacher almost, you know.
Funny because in Heart of America the roles were reversed. Nicolai was the heel and Antone was the face.
The most interesting thing I found in this article was when Betty Nicolai is talking about Mula. I think it was the match after the LA Coliseum match. Nicolai broke her nose, apparently from an errant knee from the fabulous Mula. And she talks about having to fly home with her broken nose and her face swollen and her dad having to take her to the hospital the next day to get her nose fixed and have a reconstructive surgery on her nose and her cheek and just, you know, being out of action for like a month and getting back in the ring. And it's really interesting. Like I'm so interested in the Mula or the possible fabulous Mula Betty Nicolai drama, because right. She doesn't sort of absolve not everything. Every interview I've read with her, she doesn't really absolve. She doesn't say it was Mula did it on purpose. She doesn't say Mula didn't. She just says Mula busted my nose.
It happened.
You know? So I'm so curious if there was some sort of something, you know, something there. I don't know. I'm probably making something where nothing's there, but there might be something there. I don't know. But I just found that really interesting that she talks about that specifically in terms of injuries, you know?
What I found interesting was when they're talking about their dietary habits. Now, again, who knows if this is true or not? You know, this is it. But Jean Antone said she eats only once a day, usually steak, about 2 p.m. and no snacks. On the other hand, Nikolai, Betty says, I'm 5'1" and a half and I weigh 129. I ought to weigh 10 pounds less, but I'm a compulsive eater like the rest of my Italian family. I got a sister who weighs 210. I eat my dinner before 3 in the afternoon when I'm going to wrestle, usually steak, and my other meal might be at 3 in the morning, poached eggs and some kind of meat. But in between, I eat candy bars and other sweets, the worst thing I could do.
Fantastic. Oh man, I love those. These two are just fantastic. There's an old article. I don't know if it's still up, but I've had to go to like the archive to get it, the Internet Archive with Greg Oliver, and I think it's a I think it's actually a Jean Antone interview, but it's like they're this is 30 years later, and they're sort of like, you know, it's in separate interviews of Jean Antone and Nikolai had this reporter pass on messages like Betty Nikolai says, if you ever talk to Jean Antone, tell her if I wasn't so old and decrepit, I'd still be kicking her ass to this day. She called me a dumb dago in the ring.
Oh my goodness.
And Antone responds through Greg of Oliver. Antone's response about another beating from Nikolai, who's only 5'1" herself, which replaced knee was she going to do it with? I love that these two still have this you
Yeah.
know this friendly banter for all these years. It's fantastic.
So there's an interesting paragraph in the article. Betty Nikolai has never been married, but she has had the same boyfriend for 7 years. He too is a professional wrestler, but Betty preferred not to mention his name. And I think the reason why she didn't mention his name was kayfabe. As I mentioned in Heart of America, Betty Nikolai was a heel, but I believe that the gentleman she's referring to here wrestled as actually no, that can't be right. If we take that they were dating for 7 years to heart, this would have been someone else. This would not have been her future husband, Akio Sato. Because Akio Sato, if in 1972, Betty had been dating someone for 7 years, that would mean when they first started dating, Sato was 12.
So she's
And
either fudging the numbers for the paper or,
It's possible they're fudging the numbers for the paper. It's also possible she that in the early 70s she was seeing another wrestler.
sure.
But at some point she does start dating Akio Sato, who was one of a rarity in the US, and that was a babyface Japanese wrestler. What's interesting about their relationship is that Nikolai was 10 years older than Sato. But nothing can stop true love. As the two were married on May 13th, 1976, and we believe that both are not only still living but still married. So they will be celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary next year, next May.
I
So
believe
yeah. So
one
again,
of
it's hard to, you know, when these wrestlers did articles for the newspapers, they weren't always telling the truth. So I really don't know if Betty is referring to Sato here or to someone else.
I think one of her last matches, she actually teamed with Mike York against Jean Antone, who was teaming with Akio Sato, which is
So
really
there you
funny.
go. They probably had the before wrestling between the sheets, they wrestled in the ring.
Yeah, there you go.
So her last, according to WrestlingData.com, her last documented match was about 2 months before she got married and was a singles bout against Antone. Of Nikolai's 1,203 documented matches, Antone was on the other side of the ring for 673 of them. More than
Wow.
half. And of those 673 matches, 379 of them were singles bouts. So a long time rivalry, and you know, we talked about Muhammad Hassan, Mark Capone, you know, getting out of the ring and moving on. And after Nikolai and Sato got married, Betty Nikolai retired from the ring.
Man, she,
you know, you mentioned earlier that I think it was Christianello who had been married while a wrestler. That wasn't usually the norm.
So this was
just one of those things that when they got married, she decided to become a wife, you know, first and foremost, and retired from the ring. And that was it.
Yeah, she stayed at home, raised the daughters. I think after both daughters were grown and out of the house, she went back to work. I think she started working at a nearby casino just after all that, once the girls were off to college.
Right.
Get the job at the casino. Yeah.
So another happy ending for Betty and Nikolai, and a happy ending for the happy couple, as they are, as far as we know, still together after all these years.
Yes.
Just like John and I have been together for 5 years, but unfortunately our relationship is going to experience some changes. Again, let's be clear. John and I are still friends. We'll still be friends. We'll still talk regularly, but
yes. No, there's nothing.
We won't be recording our conversations anymore.
Nothing. There's no drama behind the scenes between us. Let me make that abundantly clear.
So this month we focus on the women wrestlers. Next month, as I've mentioned, we will take a look at another group of special attractions, and that is what we today refer to as the Little Persons, but in the 1970s and, you know, for many years prior and even a few years after, they were referred to as midgets. We will focus in particular on a man who was born in London, but eventually settled in St. Joseph, Missouri. He was not only one of the top midget wrestlers of his era, he was also responsible for training many of the other midget wrestlers, and even a couple of full-size grapplers. Yes, next month, we will discuss Lord Littlebrook. We'll also have a special guest, David Gibb, author of How to Ace Your Comeback and numerous short stories about professional wrestling, is going to join us to talk about his research into the life and wrestling career of Lord Littlebrook.
Oh, fun.
I actually saw David in New Hampshire a few weeks ago when I went to a minor league baseball game there. He lives nearby, and I sort of reached out to him, said I was going to be at a game in Manchester, New Hampshire, and he decided to come on and meet up with me and enjoy the game together.
That's awesome.
Where the, I believe, the Somerset Patriots defeated the New Hampshire Fisher Cats.
Oh, that's a good name, the Fisher Cats.
Yes. That's what's coming next month. And this month, before we finish up each podcast, John and I each name one new thing we learned over the course of the last month in a segment I have cleverly titled This Month I Learned. So, John, what have you learned this month?
So one of my biggest problems when trying to get research done is getting distracted and going down rabbit holes unrelated to what I am actually trying to research. And usually these rabbit holes lead to nothing. Sometimes they yield interesting info. So when I was going over the ladies for this month, I was looking at Barbara Galento, daughter of Mario Galento, and I was trying to figure out who her mother was. Like, was it Smokey Galento? You know, so I learned that it wasn't. It was a woman named Maud. And from there, Maud led me to looking into Spider Al Galento, another.
I thought you were going to say B. Arthur.
No. That would have been another rabbit hole, another day. And this month I learned that Al Galento was Helen Hild's first husband. And that they were married from 1944 to 1950. Helen Hild, of course, was a female wrestler and a model and the mother of Ted DiBiase. And they just struck me as such a crazy couple. Spider Al Galento, if you've ever seen him, he looks like such a dangerous, scary guy. And Helen Hild was like this gorgeous 1940s blonde bombshell who looked more like Rita Hayworth than a professional wrestler.
I'm trying to imagine if Ted DiBiase had been had been the child of Helen and Spider, would have turned out.
Yeah, because her second, I think Ted's the son of her second husband, right? Like Ted Willis, I think, and then Iron Mike adopted him, right? Is that how?
Yes.
Yeah. But such a weird couple. Yeah. I was trying in vain to find a photo of them together just so I could get a sense of the dynamic, but I couldn't. But yeah.
So my This Month I Learned is related to baseball, and it's a story that might be true or might just be an urban legend, but it's a fun story because it involves baseball and beer.
Ooh, those things.
In 1953, Anheuser-Busch purchased the St. Louis Cardinals. I believe the prior owner ran into some troubles with the law and kind of sort of had to sell. So Anheuser-Busch bought them, and in particular, the Busch family. And the family wanted to rename the stadium that the Cardinals played in, which was then known as Sportsman's Park. They wanted to rename it Budweiser Stadium. Then MLB Commissioner Ford Frick denied the request, not wanting to have a stadium named after a brand of beer. So August Busch Jr. Then said, all right, we will name the stadium after our family. We will call it Busch Stadium. And not long after that, Anheuser-Busch began production on a new brand of beer, this one called Busch, which hadn't existed before. So the stadium ended up being named after a beer anyway.
That's funny.
Talk about sticking it to the man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of the things we've talked about, some of the articles and pictures of the stuff John bought me off eBay and some other things will be posted to Blue Sky and Facebook. You can catch me on Blue Sky at Al Getz. That's Algetz. bsky.social, and on the Charting the Territories group on Facebook. Also, my 6 Charting the Territories books are still available at chartingtheterritories.com if you live in the continental U.S. and worldwide on Amazon. And as I mentioned, I have taken $2 off the price of all books. But again, there won't be any future price reductions. This is going to be the final price, and I will continue to sell them on the website until supplies last and on Amazon through mid-December or so. Also, I want to say one more time, abolish ICE and fuck Trump. John, where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, seconding that statement. John.Boucher on X. I never post there. John Boucher on Blue Sky, John Boucher on Facebook. Just email me if you need me. My contact info is in all my bios for everything. Just email me because I don't check those messages. You can hear myself and Bo James on the latest episode of Outlaws to Independence, where we have a special guest, Daniel Richards, the progressive liberal.
Oh, yes.
We usually stick to older stuff, but we made a rare exception here to talk to Dan. I think for the 8-year anniversary since that hit the news, which is wild that that's 8 years ago. It doesn't seem like 8 years ago. Wow, boy, yeah. And where are we getting old?
Yeah, that CNN actually sent a crew at least one indie show somewhere in Kentucky follow Bo and Dan and Daniel Richards, the progressive liberal. That was a wild time.
Yes,
for sure. The Charting the Territories podcast comes out on the second Thursday of the month. To be the first to know when new episodes are available, subscribe now wherever you find your favorite podcast and at chartingtheterritories.com. And as I said, we will continue this podcast for the next few months or so before I finish up my run in the territory. So, John, thank you as always for your...
Thank you.
For everything you have done for Charting the Territories and for this podcast. And we will see you and we'll see all our listeners next month on the podcast.
See you next month.